Hi, I'm Ben McAdams. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center. I'm joined by Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hello, thanks for being with us.
And John Dougal on the right.
Great to be with you. Ben, always good to see you.
Yeah, great to be with you both. Thank you.
We're here in the bunker. Welcome to it.
Right here in the bunker. Missing Natalie, but I'm always happy to step in when she's out of town. But, you know, what a roller coaster it has been in politics over the last, you believe we're
24
only,
hours?
Only what? I think we're 85 days into the Trump administration, roughly.
Yeah. How you doing? How's your mental health?
You know, I was just in D.C. this week and talking to colleagues.
Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks. I've never been so grateful to lose an election as when I visit D.C. and see what a mess it has become back there. And, you know, talking to friends who are both in government or working with government, and Republicans and Democrats, people are just exhausted. The morale is low. With all that's happened with DOGE and the purge, I can just say this: government is not more efficient. It is certainly smaller, but it is not more efficient. And critical functions of our federal government are just breaking down. Things that we care about, that we want to see happen, are just breaking down. But, you know, let's turn to things that affect all of us. First of all, I wanted to talk about immigration.
Yeah.
You know, there's news out this week about this student at BYU who is in the last year of his PhD program. I was just informed that he's from Japan. He has to go back home. He can't finish his program at BYU. His wife and six kids are living here. This is the type of people we want coming here, intellectual,
Japan
contributing to our economy.
Is such a threat.
Right.
Right.
But it doesn't stop there. Many students, from, I think, almost every university in Utah and across the country are being informed that they have to leave.
Yeah. So the numbers reported last week were 20 students from the University of Utah had received this notification. There were an additional 50 that had been identified at that time. To put that in perspective, there are about 3,700 international students at the University of Utah. From a intellectual perspective, there are many important and critical contributions that folks make when they come there educated. Sometimes they are joining critical forces, areas of work that we have here in this country. We think about everything from engineers to doctors and beyond. These students are also often paying full price to come, so they are a major source of income for universities. I think that's something that needs to be acknowledged here as well. But putting all of that aside, I want to just elevate how deplorable I find this to be. These students they go through a process, they receive a visa to come here. Many of them have been informed that they are supposed to leave, self-deport, right? But they were also told that if they are deported, they may be sent somewhere that is not their home country, which should be terrifying to everyone. The University of Utah students, about half of them are from China. The other half are a mix of Middle Eastern, Southeast Asian students. And I just can't describe how disappointing this is. They were told that some of them have criminal records, though that has not been verified. It seems like there are a few traffic violations that these folks have. But categorically, they do not all have traffic violations and they do not all have criminal records. In fact, most of them do not.
Yeah. And it's not just about university students. So as I was flying home from D.C. yesterday, I was looking at two TV screens of fellow passengers, one watching a conservative news station and one watching a more progressive news station, CNN and Fox News. And they were covering this Maryland man who was arrested and deported to an El Salvadorian prison because of suspected gang ties. Now, this gets to the question of due process. John Dougal we're about to call you John Dougal Esquire.
Wow, there you go.
And, you know, due process is a concept that's often lost. It's a complicated discussion amongst lawyers, but I think this presents an opportunity to really highlight to the public what due process means. So he was deported to an El Salvadorian prison, taken away from his wife and his family because he is believed to be an MS-13 gang member. And
to which the administration said they made a mistake.
They actually admitted, correct, that he is not.
And now there's some claim in that, and we saw it bubble up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court rule, on debating facilitate versus, other words that should be used to try and bring him back. This is one of those things. First, let me step back to the BYU student. I mean, Shireen missed the elephant in the room, which is the tyranny of these artificially low speed limits, but really, it's like, seriously, we're talking a few minor traffic tickets is why somebody from Japan is going to be deported. That makes no sense to me. I'm all for cracking down on the hardened criminals that are preying on society. A few minor traffic tickets.
That is not it.
That is not it. And so I just struggle with that concept right there in and of itself, going, this is such massive overreach. And then you get to due process, the ability to contest and say, no, this isn't me, or the rules in this case don't apply here. I should not be deported, whatever the situation might be.
Should have a chance to prove that you're not a gang member,
yeah.
Right?
So,
make the case. And so then, okay, he gets deported. And now the administration's saying, well, we can't really bring him back. We don't really have any power. It's like hogwash. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're helping fund the prison. You put your foot down. You've been able to bring folks back that were improperly deported in the
past. From
Russia,
you can
do these type of things.
You engage
in difficult negotiations. So this is just an excuse. And I think for a lot of folks, you know, that support deporting the truly bad actors, this is where you lose support when you go, seriously, you made a mistake and you won't correct the mistake, or you're applying it in such a, you know, relatively
haphazard,
you know, harmless way to somebody that largely is truly a benefit to society.
So due process, help people just understand the concept.
So it's, you know, the Constitution, it's embedded in the Constitution. It says, essentially, you cannot deprive a person, it doesn't say citizen, it says a person of rights under the law without due process of the law. So in the case of this person who's allegedly an MS-13 gang member and a criminal, I would support deporting criminals who have committed violent crimes and are part of a, you know, terrorist organization. Deport them. But apparently this individual has a tattoo that some people thought was a gang affiliation. So due process would say you can't make that judgment and deport them without giving them a chance under the law to establish the facts.
Yes.
And that doesn't require citizenship. You are a person, whether or not you are a citizen. So he was deprived of due process and deported and taken away from his wife and his children that he's raising and sent to a prison and incarcerated without due process.
Yes.
Very clear violation of the Constitution. If you care about the Constitution, you care about the rights of this individual. If he is an MS-13 gang member, the government can prove that and can deport him.
Different. Yes. Okay. So, and I just want to add on to this. I think what's so troubling from my perspective, both of you with a legal background, not for me, but I think what people need to understand is that if this individual does not have due process, neither do we.
Yes.
That can be stripped from any of us, because all they have to say is, he's a gang member. She's a gang member. They're part of a terrorist organization with no requirement to provide proof around that. And then you can be ripped out of here. And I just want people to understand this is not abstract. This is happening right now. And I do think that it is just part of a broader chaos agenda of this administration, where there are going to be very serious consequences. And it is impossible to dial this back, even though it should be possible, right? Because we had Bukele, who's the president of El Salvador, visit the White House this week. Trump could have asked for these individuals who have been improperly removed from this country to be returned. He wouldn't even ask. And in fact, what he did is accelerate it and say, next, we're going to ask you to take our homegrown criminals. So this is all a very, very concerning trend, I think, for people's basic human rights, for the rights and our upholding of the Constitution. And I have to say, I called my representative this week. I called his office, asked if he had any statement about it. And all I heard from the person who answered the phone was lip service. Yes, your representative sure cares about the Constitution. I was like, well, I haven't seen my representative say anything about it. So I'm very concerned.
And whether you're liberal or conservative, you do not want your government to be able to violate your due process. The Constitution was put in place to restrain the powers of our government. And the government has exceeded the powers given to it under the Constitution.
Yeah.
Well, and this also gets to the thing that you're alluding to right there, Ben, which is we create either programs, or we give authority to, in this case, the president, thinking, okay, it's going to be used this way, forgetting that, you know, when you give broad grants of authority, that can be used any of a number of ways.
Yeah.
And what happens when, you know, if you're conservative and the next president is liberal and is incarcerating people who are suspected of white supremacy or suspected of some other offense to liberal values, you want constraints on your president. You want constraints on your government.
So give another example of the ways in which our representatives seem to have handed over the reins to the Trump administration, and it's around the trade war. So you've had experience in Congress. Tell us a little bit about
condolences.
How do tariffs work? Like, typically, is that a process that Congress has a role in?
Well, tariffs are a tax on imports, right? And typically, Congress absolutely has a role in that and an ability to constrain the president. In fact, our own Senator Mike Lee has introduced legislation to reassert Congress's authority over tariffs. Now, that has changed now that the president is Donald Trump. He no longer cares about that, that yep. legislation. But absolutely, this is a tax on the American people. The president does have the authority to do that, but historically, Congress has had a role as a check on the president's tariff authority, and Congress should reassert that power.
I totally agree.
Well, and Congress technically has the broad power, and the president's supposed to operate within the box that Congress defines on this, and Congress has washed their hands largely. Yeah. And
yes,
I don't care. You know, Obama, Trump, Biden, Trump, George W. Bush, whatever it might be, we give too much power to our presidents.
So what we're seeing now is chaos. Last week when we recorded, John, there was the pause, I guess, again, a 90-day pause on the extremely high tariffs, again, a tax on the American people, mostly
a pause.
Broad, except for China, that now faces, I guess, 245% tariffs. But to be clear, on everyone else, there was still an increase, a 10% increase on everyone else. And so those are costs that are hitting business owners that, you know, are making it difficult for people to plan if they're going to have build a factory here or, you know, develop a new line of whatever there. Like, there's a lot of chaos that's been introduced into the market.
There's a lot of demand for whatever.
Because of the trade war.
Well, it creates uncertainty. You know, yeah. We've talked about this. If you're a business person and you're looking to expand or invest in your business and now you don't know, that causes you to be uncertain. And when it's on again, off again, okay, great, it's paused for 90 days. What's going to happen in 90 days? And usually these investments take months or years to come to fruition.
Yeah.
And you don't want to put that money down if all of a sudden, boom, the rug's going to be yanked out from under you.
Well, you know, this show is both sides of the aisle. So I do have to chime in with the fact that, you know, we have a Republican president now that we are upset with his actions. But I have to say Democrats have failed. This is, you know, I don't want to both sides it because I don't think that the failures are equal on both sides. But Democrats for decades have failed to take action on their own part, to rein in the powers of the executive, to have a Congress that functions, to pass a budget, to adapt regulations to fit the realities of the world we live in.
Yeah.
And Democrats have failed. And so a lot of what we're dealing with now is people who are frustrated and willing to throw a grenade in the tent because government is so broken. And I do think Democrats have to own some of that for failing to step up and to solve the problems that people are facing. We passed the Inflation Reduction Act that invests unprecedented amounts in clean energy and climate reduction, and we cannot permit solar power and some of the things that were funded under that because the regulations are so burdensome.
Well, maybe after the break, we can talk a bit more about regulation because I know we have many diverse opinions on it here and more.
Great. Well, you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams, and I'm with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And I'm Ben McAdams in the political middle. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. All right, Shireen, you teed us up on regulation.
Regulation.
Way too much.
I know you think that. So I caught an interesting article in the New York Times that was talking about the White House's plan to slash regulations. This is right out of Project 2025, which I feel like, John, you sat here for many weeks and told me was not going to be the playbook. It is the playbook. So we're living in...
Yeah, but we've been talking about cutting regulations since long before that playbook ever came along.
True. But I'll just say that there are elements of this where I think actually maybe not a surprise to listeners, but we will find common ground. I think there are lots of places where regulation has slowed innovation. I think we're going to talk a little bit from the left, places where we see the ways in which regulation has made things like addressing housing, our housing crisis, really complicated, even addressing some of the things that we need to do around climate change. But what we're talking about here is much broader than that. You know, I think there is opportunity for good in all of this, but I'll tell you where I'm very concerned. When I see things like regulation to have more medical staff on duty in nursing homes, I think that's something that many people who've had loved ones in nursing homes would like to see. When we think about baby formula safety, safety of meat packaging, airplane safety, chemical pollution to water and air, worker safety, there should be a process around some of these. And what I would like to see, What I think would be reasonable is that we start with those regulations we clearly know are outdated. For example, things around telegrams that may not serve us very well anymore. I'm great using AI to get rid of those. That sounds great.
We are not talking about the telegram app for some of you out there. No. We are talking about the old school pre-telegraphone.
Yes. Yeah. So well, that
wasn't I think there something like Back to the Future when he went back Wait, to I mean, Wild West, yeah, something like
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah. Received a telegram.
I'm certain those regulations would still apply. But here, what we're saying is there is opportunity to better address the kinds of regulations that have prevented the kind of innovation that we may need in particular sectors. And then there are also regulations that simply keep people safe. And there has to be some matrix by which this is assessed, as opposed to throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
All right, John Dougal, she served up a softball.
So let me step back. I mean, you know, first thing, we talk about regulations and we forget that when we're doing the regulations, you're talking government regulations. And I come from the world which is everything is regulated. Whenever you and I decide to buy or not buy something, we are regulating the market. We're regulating those goods, those services. And so the notion that the government must be or is going to be the primary regulator, I just disagree with that belief. You talked about nursing home, for example. It sounds great. Oh, we want more staff in nursing homes. Effectively, what that means is, one, what I was hearing is we want the federal government to do this. And I come from the perspective, which is let's bring it more local. And if we're going to have it, let local decisions decide. But part of what happens there is we're going to drive out the cost, which means some people that might get a, you know, care that they need today all of a sudden can't afford it. And they're in a worse situation as a result because of this well-intended regulation. And one of the big concerns I have is regulatory capture. Because you watch government get co-opted by, you know, big labor or big business. And people go laughing all the way to the bank. And there's a regulatory capture concept called bootleggers and Baptists. Think back to Prohibition, okay? Who made the moral case for Prohibition, if you will? The Baptists, the religious folks. Who went laughing all the way to the bank? The bootleggers. And you see that time and time again when folks made the case for, drug benefits in Obamacare, okay? Who was making the moral case for it? And who was making the money in the deal? And I tell folks, you always have to look. Any kind of regulation, it's going to get captured. Look at who's making the case for it and who's making the money in it.
And this is an argument that I've heard from John Dougal from our days serving together in the legislature. And I honestly, frequently we have sided with you. You remember even legislation that you voted, that you proposed then, and I was sometimes the sole Democrat voting with your legislation to deregulate. We have to acknowledge that Democrats have used regulation as the one key on the piano that we keep hitting, and we think that it's going to solve everything. New York Times columnist Ezra Klein calls it everything bagel liberalism, that we just keep throwing regulations. And where we are today is housing is unaffordable. We can't build a home, especially using federal dollars, because it just becomes so expensive. We can't permit clean energy. We can't build clean energy because of all of the regulations that we've piled on it. So again, I'm not going to both sides this, but I do have to say shame on Democrats for not fixing this when we controlled the majority, because people are now so fed up that they're willing to just throw a grenade in the tent, which is not the answer either.
Which is not the answer. But speaking of people being fed up, I think I hung out with about 20,000 of them.
Yeah, tell us about that. Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez here in Utah.
Yes. So on Sunday night, about 20,000 people showed up. The Huntsman Center holds about 15. I actually think they capped it at about 14, and there was a very sizable crowd outside that also got a direct address from Senator Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But I'll just say there were a couple things that really stood out to me. One was, you know, how frustrated people are with, Bernie identifies as a little outside of the Democratic Party, right? And mentioned there are ways in which I do believe Democrats have failed us in this moment. I will also say that, you know, was supported by the crowd. There was a sense of a feeling frustration with the same old way that things have been done over time. I'll also say the most important thing that he said, or I guess the thing that stuck with me the most, was the question that he raised that just said, how many people, regardless of their political affiliation, think it's okay for anyone, in this case, Elon Musk, to spend $280 million getting Trump elected to then hold the most powerful position in government? And that was a moment that I thought really hit. And I do believe that however people may feel about Bernie Sanders, there's a lot of agreement in the way that he talks about how money plays out in our politics. And I do think that most people, reasonable people, again, across the political spectrum, think that it's not okay for somebody to buy power, but that is exactly what our system does.
You weren't there, I take it.
I was not there, I'm not a big rally guy, regardless of which party he's doing.
Yeah.
But I've told folks for a long time, since going back before Trump got elected the first time, Bernie and Trump, I consider, are two different sides of the same coin. It's the mad as hell caucus. And they're articulating how the system has been rigged and stacked and biased against the everyday working person.
Yeah.
And I think in many ways, they're absolutely right. And while their proposals are very different, they're talking to the same kind of folks.
Yeah.
About the same anger, frustration, agitation, fear that just comes from, I just want to work. I just want to provide for my family. And I just feel like everything is getting more expensive and it's harder to live. And everything's stacked against me.
Yeah. And I'd say another piece that stood out was just, you know, the commentary of AOC. I live with a person who listens to conservative radio because he wants to know what they're saying. And the number of times that I have heard her name called out specifically and her being degraded for having worked as a waitress is a standard talking point on the right. And I'll just say the thing that was so impressed, like I was impressed in the moment where she said, the reason that they make fun of me is because they think that you should all just be rich. It is like fundamentally kind of an anti-working person's message. And I would hope that people who consume that kind of messaging really think about what it says when we make fun of somebody who is smart, who is articulate, who worked as a waitress. Those are the kinds of people I would prefer to see in Congress, honestly, yeah. than some of the whack jobs that we're seeing that seem more interested in, you know, honestly, some pretty fringe ideas.
Well, I was out of town, so wasn't able to attend the rally, but I had many friends and family that were there, and everybody seemed...
Did you record it for them?
Yeah.
No, it live streamed on YouTube.
It did.
So, yes.
You can watch it.
But I have many friends and family that were there, and people came away very energized. Yeah. Little factoid, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and I were elected to Congress the same year, and we're actually seatmates on the House Financial Services Committee. So I would always say at the time, that, you know, so we do have a friendship, and I would say that I'm to the right of AOC figuratively and literally. So I sat right next to her on her right.
Yeah. Okay. So I think kind of connected to this, maybe we should talk briefly about what was announced today in terms of labor leaders' push to get the anti-union bill, which was an anti-collective bargaining bill that was passed at the legislature this year. They were a referendum was enacted and they had 30 days to collect signatures. And you want to report on some of the numbers?
Yeah. So they announced today that they had gathered 320,000 signatures, which is double what's required. Now, there's also a requirement that it's captured in 25 of 29 counties, I believe, in order to have a referendum.
There's got to be a certain
distribution of signatures. You can't gather them all in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
So a distribution, which they assert that they have achieved. And so now it goes to the Lieutenant Governor's office to verify signatures.
Yeah.
Verify signatures. And then the opposition has, I think it's 45 days.
More days.
To get people, convince them to withdraw their signature.
And I just want to let people know, you know, what this is asking is, should we vote on this? So if you get contacted to, you know, ask, you know, that you take off your signature, I think the question you need to ask yourself is, do you think the Utah voters should be able to vote on this issue or not? That's what we're asking.
Well, the other thing I would ask is, why do you think that arch conservative FDR was opposed to government labor unions? Ask yourself, why was he opposed to it? And why are we allowing it today?
And I would answer that question for us.
Well, I just think there's problems with it. I have no problem if people want to associate with each other.
Private sector unions or...
Well, private sector or do their own thing. I have problems when all of a sudden the government is forced to negotiate with certain unions, forced to engage in certain activities. You know, let all folks be free to advocate their positions and advocate for what they think is best. But you get this co-opted situation here where they kind of play on both sides of the table when it comes to spending taxpayer dollars.
So this is the debate that if they are successful with their signatures, the debate started here and it'll continue all the way up until the vote on the referendum.
Well, and I will add this, that I think there's something pretty incredible about when we see federal regulations being stripped away from worker protections and safety, when we see the ways in which it's getting harder and harder to make a living here, unions may be the last backstop that folks have.
Well said. In our final moments, let's talk about the University of Utah. There's been some controversy at the University of Utah as it relates to programs and faculty. Trine, do you want to walk us through that?
Well, I think John's maybe teed up to do it. But what I'll say is that we're seeing across the board, the university system in Utah is facing cuts. And so there are going to be program collapsing or elimination of some programs, but there's also a bit of
controversy. Don't have many students, and we've had a plethora of programs offered around, and just to deal with the costs, they're trying to rein in that, cut the programs that are inefficient, that aren't really serving students. And then there's also a battle about what is the balance of power between presidents of institutions and their faculty.
Their faculty center.
Too much power has been given to faculties over the years, and the legislature made clear, presidents, you're the ones supposed to run the institutions.
It's not surprising. Well, I would say that is a surprising position from a body that seems pretty interested in empowering themselves. The legislative branch sure seems to take bites from the governor's power, but now they're saying, presidents, it's back on you.
And this is an historic context of universities have typically been a bastion of academic freedom. We want our universities to push
allegedly,
the boundaries. But we want universities to push the boundaries in every direction. And this is where innovation and ideas flow that challenge the norms of society. Sometimes that's offensive, but that kind of is the purpose.
And yet these academic senates tend to be wet blankets to fight against innovation within their institutions.
So that is the argument.
That's the argument.
All of that in a time where pride flags are being banned on campuses, and it is a tough time to be a university faculty member. We have several friends who are.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Again, I'm Ben McAdams. I've been joined by Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. And thank you to our producer, Anthony Skolmup. And thank you for listening.